A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete.
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
Okay, everybody, this is Alex Barnett from the Comedians at Law. Welcome you to episode 35 of the Comedians at Law podcast. I'm joined in the booth today by none other than my colleague and muscle-bound man, Kevin Israel. Yes. Say hello, Kevin.
Hello, Kevin.
Very good. Right on cue. Kevin and I are taking the helm this week to bring you all the news and all the stuff that's fit and not fit to print in the legal comedy sphere. And we've got some really great stuff this week, Kev, so let's get right into it, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Lots of stuff going on.
Yeah. Well, first, let's talk about what we've got on our calendar upcoming in the next couple of weeks. We've got a few really exciting things. You and I are going to go down to D.C. and do a private show.
Road trip,
right? It's going to be very exciting. Nothing more exciting than two guys doing a drive down to D.C., half an hour of comedy, drive back, especially when one of them is a dad with a toddler.
That's not me.
Right.
But, folks, this is not a glamorous lifestyle. In case you listen to us and you think, wow, how can I follow in these guys' footsteps? Don't.
Well, I think we should – no, but you know what? You make a fair point. Let's try to buck the trend. Let's try to go against hype. Let's do something to liven up the road trip. Maybe – I don't know. Maybe we stop at a rest stop on the New Jersey Turnpike on the way down. We'll get some beef jerky.
Hey, you know what we can do to liven up the road trip?
What's that?
You can drive 5 miles over the speed limit. that would be lively.
Listen, I can't just, you know, be freewheeling like that. I'm not just living for myself now. I'm living for my wife and my son. They expect me to get down and come back in one piece, or at least two recognizable pieces.
Alex Barnett lives in constant fear while driving of either some horrific car accident or the state police.
Yes.
I don't know if you had some traumatic experience when you were a child, but it's readily apparent in your driving.
Well, listen, safety first, because I'm not letting you drive with your Camaro and your T-top and your Bon Jovi blasting out the sides.
It'll be a lot more fun, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, but we'll get pulled over and probably wind up in jail for excessive New Jerseying.
Maybe that's what Comedians of Law needs. Maybe we need a stint in the joint.
Well, you do, and then I will be happy to represent you and bail you out.
I know. I'm getting a good lawyer.
Yeah, well, right. You wouldn't want me. But I could get your sentence reduced from, like, 3 years down to, like, 2.5.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So Kevin and I are doing this road trip, and then right thereafter, I think, a week – right after Memorial Day, we've got a gig in New Jersey, Kev, right?
Yeah, we're taking the legal comedy to New Jersey, to the Comedy Shop, which are some friends of ours. They run a comedy club at Brick 46 in Rockaway, New Jersey, at 68 U.S. Highway 46 in Rockaway, New Jersey. We have a show June 8th, 9:30 p.m. Again, that's a comedy shop at Brick 46. It's going to be an awesome show. It's a cool spot, intimate. They always do right by us in our independent comedy careers, and they're very excited about having us as Comedians at Law. And you can find out about them about that show anyway at www.jjcomedy.com. You can check out our cool little poster, buy tickets, and get more information on the show. But again, that's June 8th at 9:30 at Brick 46 with the Comedy Shop. So it's going to be a great show.
Yeah, and then right thereafter, I guess 2 weeks after that, we've got our first of our monthly shows that are partnerships with the Gotham Comedy Foundation. This show, June 21st at 7:30 p.m., will be at Gotham Comedy Club, which is located 208 West 23rd Street in New York, New York. And again, it is the first one that we're doing in affiliation and partnership with the Gotham Comedy Foundation, so we're very excited about that.
That's big. I'm excited about this.
Yeah, me too, and I know they are too. I mean, I know you've been talking to the fellow who's doing the PR for them, and I've talked to Bill Drews, the head of the foundation. They're both very excited about working with us and about what we're doing. So people should come out, and if they want tickets or more information about the show, they should email us at info@comediansatlaw.com. Again, that's info@comediansatlaw.com. And if they want to buy tickets, tickets are available already on the Gotham website at Gotham Comedy. Let me just make sure I get the right address. GothamComedyClub.com, I believe. And that is right, GothamComedyClub.com. So I think that's what we got coming up. And why don't we go ahead and get right into the news, because we've got a short amount of time this week.
Yes, we got some interesting things going on. Let's start off with the
Hold on, let's just take a quick break to change over, and we'll get right to the news.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
Okay, Kev, the news. I know you were busy researching this all afternoon, so I'll let you take the lead here.
I spent some serious time digging up the most interesting stories on the web. I want to talk about the IRS.
Oh, my goodness. Well, as if that's not already been plastered across the news for the last, 24 hours, 7 days a week for the last week?
But I think this is really surprising, and we don't have to go partisan on this, but, the IRS is being accused of, and well, actually not just accused of, they've actually admitted to improperly singling out certain conservative political groups when those groups applied for nonprofit status. They apparently held them to a higher level of scrutiny, their applications, and Stephen Miller, who was the director or the temporary director of the IRS, was now fired by President Obama over this scandal, but ironically he was set to step down anyway.
Right. Well, let me just interrupt you. I don't think it was inappropriately targeting these groups, because these groups are talking out of both sides of their mouths, because they think government's terrible, but then they want government protection for their political activities.
So. Well, in fairness, for these groups to participate in the political process, just by what's set up, they have to follow these guidelines. If they want to raise money to support candidates, they have to file under certain IRS regulations. Obviously, a lot of these groups are probably more fringe conservative groups who want no federal government at all. But regardless, they have to follow the rules, and to their credit, they were following the rules. And because of their political beliefs, regardless of how crazy you might think they are, they were being unfairly targeted. And I think I think that's a serious problem. I think they need to run up the chain of command, because Stephen Miller just kind of he was fired. I'm sure they worked out a deal with him because he was stepping down anyway. And you now have congressmen and senators on both sides of the aisle calling for a much more in-depth review of what's going on. They want answers.
Right. Well, look, I mean, obviously we don't want the government, the IRS, targeting people, to specifically go out and try to find them so they can audit them. On the other hand, I do think these groups are playing it a little bit fast and loose with the definition of a 501c4. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're seeking protection, social welfare protection of their organization, when they're not really about social welfare. They're about espousing a political agenda.
Yes, you're right. These are all groups that have specific political leanings and are looking to promote their political agenda. But also, and again, if you want to be able to give money to your candidates, if you want to be able to promote your candidates, you have to be filed as one of these organizations. You have to show that you're a nonprofit and the monies are going to political means, and that's what they have to do if they want to be able to compete. And I think the bigger concern here than with these groups in question, because you can say whatever you want about them, is that this really kind of hogties people who might want to get into the political process, of any political leaning. They might just look at this and go, why bother getting involved? I'm not going to be, the federal government is going to keep me from trying to play their game.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's a little bit of an overreach to say that this is going to somehow chill people getting involved in the political process, because we see all the time people get involved in the political process because they want to forward an agenda. I think that what's going to happen is the Republicans, in an effort to make some political hay out of this, are really going to overreach, both politically and in terms of legislation with respect to the IRS. Because I think what's going to wind up happening is they're going to hamstring these guys, and then when there's legitimate reasons to audit, like a big corporate, like an ExxonMobil, for example, who we all know cheats wildly on their taxes and pays like next to nothing, even though they make billions of dollars of profit based on government subsidies, they're going to get away with murder. Because
Alex Barnett says bitterly.
I'm not bitter. I'm just calling it as I see it. So
listen, the fact is that and by the way, these groups weren't being audited. This was just the application process. This isn't a question of auditing. This is a question of how these applications are reviewed, how they're selected for a given level of scrutiny, and who makes these decisions. And I think what the question is going to be is how high up knew that this was happening, and was this? I mean, look. He admitted, Director Miller admitted that this was a pattern of behavior, that it was foolish, and that there was some kind of political discrimination going on in the IRS, and he admitted that it was wrong. Okay, so we've now gotten through that.
There you go. That could be the end of the inquiry, right? I mean, in other words, let's you know, I don't understand why there's now an attempt to lay this at the foot of the president.
What if he – I mean, it's – did he know? Shouldn't
well,
he
that's,
know?
That's what
should
I take
he know
issue
if our president is using a federal body for political means?
You mean like President Nixon, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, this isn't partisan at all. If this was a Republican doing it, if it was a Democrat doing it, I don't care. I don't want to see our federal government using the agencies that are supposed to be working – supposedly for the citizens, as you know, as political weapons.
Right. So, for example, like President Bush, who used the CIA to cook up some phony intelligence to launch a war.
And that was stupid. And he will burn in effigy because of it.
Right. Or, for example, President Reagan, who sold weapons to the Iranians, our known enemy, so he could finance the Contras against the actual legislation passed by Congress. You know,
you will not besmirch the record of President Reagan.
Oh, my goodness. Well, the point is, listen, if you want to say that what the IRS did was stupid, that there should be investigation, absolutely. But I don't like the fact that the Republicans, particularly Daryl Issa, come right out of the chute claiming that the president knew about this, that he ordered it, that it's obviously a conspiracy. And that,
listen, the IRS is an entity that falls under the executive branch.
No, it's not. It's an independent agency. I mean, it is technically
it's under the Department of Treasury.
But it's technically within the executive branch. But you know as well as anybody that it is an independent agency that is not under direct oversight of the president.
Listen, I would want to know who knew what and who gave the orders. Who gave the orders to do this? Because Miller said he didn't.
Well,
Miller said he didn't know anything about it.
I'm sending you down there because. Because you need something to do.
I'll go down there. I'll go down there and crack some heads.
All right. I know you will. We'll put their heads in the crook of your arm and a beer in the crook of the other arm, and you'll open up a head just like it's a Budweiser, right?
I will open up a can of whoop-ass on the IRS.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next story. I think this is obviously we'll have to watch this and see how it unfolds. And,
I'm sure it's going to unfold extensively.
It is going to unfold extensively, and I can't wait till the Republicans wind up with an egg on their face from it.
See, I want to point out that I stayed as nonpartisan as possible.
You did, and I did not. And
you've
been nothing but
a Democrat hack. Moving on.
Okay.
Moving on.
All right, next.
This is something that I think you and I won't necessarily argue over.
Which is?
Harvard Law is apparently opening applications to juniors. And when I saw this headline, I didn't know what they meant. I didn't know if they meant younger people.
Right.
Or people who were named after their father.
Right.
But as it turns out, they're actually opening up applications to juniors in college.
Well, let me tell you something. Let me stop you right there. I'm against this. Why? I'll tell you for several reasons. Number one, Harvard did not admit my application for undergrad, law school, or when I applied for a master's of public administration at the Kennedy School. So I already don't like Harvard to begin with. They're snotty and arrogant and condescending. So anything they do, I'm against.
All right, and I would like to say that that Harvard has had us at their campus twice.
Right,
and,
except for that one time, they were very nice to us.
And they're wonderful people. They had great popcorn, and they provided some great sandwiches the first time around, and we appreciate their patronage.
I will say this. The people at Harvard are very nice. The institution itself, snotty and arrogant and condescending, like I said.
And very wealthy.
And wealthy, right, on top of which it's all the things that normal people like you and I, people who didn't do well, who aren't necessarily as smart or sophisticated and don't have money, we should hate these people. They're the noblesse oblige. They're the Plutarchs of our society.
Hey, I'm sophisticated. Listen,
knowing what number to put the sun tanning dial on doesn't make you a sophisticated or aristocrat.
Right now, I am a shocking tone of pale. But listen, so anyway, the crux of this whole new plan by Harvard Law is that juniors in undergraduate colleges may apply in their junior year, provided they agree to work for 2 years in between graduation and beginning their law school studies. So I guess you can apply as a junior, then you go through your senior year, then you have to work 2 years, and then you can start law school.
Well, what's the point of all that?
I don't really fully understand it. They say the program is intended to allow students to square away the graduate school plan early so they can focus on finding the right job and gain several years of real-world experience. I wonder if this is a way to get to weed out some people from law school, maybe. To get them into the working world, and maybe they'll say, oh, I like a paycheck. I don't necessarily need to go to law school.
Because this sounds like the silliest thing I've ever heard of. I mean, it doesn't sound like I know a guy, younger guy, who just applied to law school. He'll be going in the fall to Brooklyn Law School here in New York, and he told me that Brooklyn has implemented a plan where people can go in 2 years by going straight through for 24 months.
And I think that's a great idea.
Well, right. So I said, that's a great idea, just like you just said. And then he said, but you don't pay any less money because the tuition the tuition for the 2 years is exactly the same as it is for the 3 years. The only difference in money at all is that you don't pay for, let's say, living expenses for that third year. So it's a ruse because the school doesn't care about your living expenses. They care about the tuition.
See, I think you and I have talked a few episodes ago about the problems with the law school education and the way it's set up. And the expectations. And this is I don't know if this is an attempt by Harvard to cure some of those ills. Doesn't seem to be. They're not really affected changing the curriculum or the actual blueprint of law school. I don't know what the impetus behind this is. I don't know if it is if it is to weed out some applicants. Maybe I guess if you're Harvard Law School, you really don't care about the money necessarily as much. You just want the best students who are going to be lawyers and who are really passionate about it. But it seems that other law schools, and it's said if this is successful, other law schools might consider doing this. Why would you – don't you want as many applicants as possible? Don't you – isn't that what you're
– Let me ask you something. If you had had the chance to do this back in your junior year, would you – well, wait a second. That's a bad question because you want to do the seven-year college program. So I don't know that you had a junior year, right?
I don't even remember my junior
year. Yeah, you didn't have a junior.
I'm sure it happened. And it was awesome.
I mean, from my perspective, if Harvard really wants to correct the inequities in the legal system or the legal education system, they could start by giving me a Harvard law degree so that maybe I could get somewhere in life.
I think you have to earn that, Alex. I don't think they're just
going to give it to you. I feel like I'm entitled at this point, from the dues I've paid in various fields of endeavor, to an honorary law degree from Harvard.
Listen, if you want to talk about entitlement, I have a mortgage worth of debt from law school that I probably will never actually pay back.
Look, you and I both performed at Harvard Law, and we had to go there twice to do it, right?
Yep.
So, and I've paid dues in the legal field and in the comedy field. At this point, I don't understand why Harvard isn't just FedExing me an honorary law degree, an honorary JD.
I'll tell you why. I never felt more out of place than when I was standing in the Harvard Law School. Whatever that entry area was, I felt like everybody was looking at us. I felt like it was that scene
You don't even know because you can't even think of something that highbrow.
I'm just drawing a blank.
I felt like Carson the Butler in Downton Abbey.
Okay, you went really, really highbrow. Thanks.
Yeah, because if you watch Downton Abbey, you know that the servants are forced to live in the downstairs, like the cellar level of the.
My analogy was going to be
what some comic book thing. I felt like
when the guys from Animal House went into the bar that was an all black bar, and everybody just stopped and stared at them.
I can assure you this: there aren't enough black people at Harvard Law to make an all black bar.
That's true. That's true, and that joke has two meanings if you think about it.
That's right. So in any event, so they're going to allow juniors who are really motivated and very smart, which is probably like three people in the world, to apply.
But so these kids are going to go, they're going to get a job, a real job, whatever, doing whatever it is. They're going to work for 2 years and then they're going to say, hey, I appreciate the job, but later I'm going to Harvard Law School.
Right.
That just seems, I don't know, it seems counterintuitive. I get the idea that you... That's some law students. I worked for 7-8 years before I went back to law school. It didn't make me one inch of a better lawyer or a law school student. But I get that the idea is that, you know, maybe working for a couple of years offers some level of maturity and preparation for law school, which is a bunch of crap because law school has nothing to do with lawyering.
Let's keep an eye on this, son. I'm the proof is in the pudding on this. I'm not sure that this is going to achieve anything.
I don't think so either, but you're right. Let's put this in our little to watch bank and see what happens.
I'll tell you what would convince me more about the efficiency and efficacy of this thing is if Harvard Law brings us back to perform there again, I might think twice about my views on this subject.
Well, at least, Alex, at least you let things go.
All right. Let's move on to our third news topic for the week.
All right, the final topic of the week was an article that I found about certain intellectual property law issues.
Which is our specialty, obviously.
Yes, yes, obviously. We if it has intellectual in it, it's Comedians at Law. How 3D – these 3D printers are going to impact intellectual property law.
First of all, let me stop you there. How is there a 3D printer?
You don't know about this?
I mean, I've heard the term, but I still don't understand. Like, it prints out something that's three-dimensional?
Yes.
So isn't that actually just called a manufacturing machine?
Yeah, actually, essentially, that is what it is. It's not, yeah, it's not paper that's turning, being, you know, it's not paper that suddenly becomes origami and you have a microwave. It's these printers use different substances, types of plastic. They print them out in layers. And it as it prints out, it builds up into whatever design you're attempting to make. They come in a variety of sizes, and you can build a whole bunch of different things. These have been very controversial because one of the big things everybody talks about is you can apparently build a gun off of one of these.
Oh, I saw this. I saw that on the television.
On the television.
On the television. No, on MSNBC, because I only watch MSNBC. I can't watch anything else. They did a whole thing about these guys who are like anarchists or nihilists who showed how to build a plastic gun with plastic bullets using one of these 3D printers.
Yes. Yes. It seems possible that you can really almost build anything off of these 3D printers if you have the right – whatever the right printing material is. And by the way, the gun that you're printing ostensibly is plastic.
That's what I'm saying.
Not only are you making a gun, you're making a gun that's undetectable.
Right. Well, that was the whole point of the news piece that I watched, but you wouldn't watch because it's on a liberal media outlet. But it was horrifying. Horrifying.
For the record, I didn't even acknowledge that little jab because I'm above that.
Right. But it's horrifying because think about it. Like now, how do you screen at airports? How do you screen anywhere for these guys if you can't detect? There's no metal in it.
It is very concerning, and I think one of the concerns here when it comes to the IP law aspect is that this is really getting to science fiction type realm, because you could basically take almost anything, picture just for you know, a toy, you could take an action figure, scan it into your computer with however that works, and then you could just print out as many of them as you want.
Oh, I see. So the idea is that people are just going to be ripping off technology left and right, because as long as you can get the item in the first place.
Right. You could essentially recreate it on your 3D printer.
Oh, I'm surprised that the Chinese aren't already doing this, like, you know, left, right, and center.
Let's be honest. They probably are.
Right.
But this is the whole 3D printer thing. It took me a number of months to really be able to digest how these things work and that they're real. It always reminds me of in Star Trek The Next Generation, they had these food makers. I can't remember what it was called, but they hit a button and basically any food you wanted appeared. They never really explained the science behind it.
Right.
This seems to be a step in that direction, which is kind of cool but kind of horrifying because you can apparently make anything. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of good that comes out of these. I'm sure certain products and certain materials are going to become much more affordable. But then you do have these nutcases who are going to make guns and rocket launchers and tanks. Who knows?
I have to be honest. It's horrifying about the weapons part. The equally horrifying is the IP part because I don't understand it. I mean, I really don't. I know that you get a patent or a trademark, and that's as far as I go. I mean, I don't know how you. I actually had to get a trademark for the stuffed animal company that my wife and I had, and the fact that we actually were given a trademark was just dumb luck. Like, I don't know how I filled out the form.
Well, I'm not gonna lie, I didn't take any IP classes in law school either, and actually, IP is really its own little legal field.
Yeah.
It's almost, it could almost be a separate school, but it's very complicated.
Well, let's back up. I mean, let's face it. IP lawyers are about the driest people you're ever going to meet.
Yes, agreed.
Right.
I mean, there's never going to be an NBC hit series about IP law. I don't think.
Unless they call it IP Daily, right?
And,
then,
and that's the only enjoyable part. Just saying the title.
Right. Starring William Shatner as the crusty old IP lawyer.
He might make it interesting. He might actually make it enjoyable.
I think we should pitch that show. I think we should pitch a hard-edged, provocative IP law television drama.
Well, you know what? Listen, Law & Order has done everything else. Maybe we get a Law & Order IP.
That's what we should have people tweet us about.
Coming up
with a premise for the IP for the IP law show.
If you can come up with something that we find moderately entertaining to make an IP law show about, we will send you, guess what, a T-shirt.
We should really do this, by the way. We should do a video, a Comedians Law, the IP law. We should make a trailer for the IP law show.
I think we should do it as a Law & Order spinoff. That way we can have those cool chimes or gongs or whatever makes that
noise. Yes, I'm writing this down. Law & Order IP.
And, I like this. See, if you're listening to our podcast, you just saw how the creative process and Comedians at Law work.
That's right. It only would have been a lot better if either one of us was – or both of us was high or drunk. Because then we would have spun this out and come up with the casting for it. And
we would be making it right now.
That's right. Guerrilla television.
Which, by the way, hey, speaking of which, here's a little teaser. Comedians at Law is going to be filming a first in a series of videos this weekend. Should be up on the web maybe in 2 weeks, so keep an eye out for it. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. So, Kev, this is very exciting for us and for me personally. Our interview this week on the interview portion of the show, which we cleverly call interview, is none other than Emerson Moore, who is general counsel at TMP Worldwide and also my brother-in-law. So stay tuned for this interview. All right, folks, this is Alex Barnett of Comedians at Law, and I am pleased this week to have as our podcast none other than Emerson Moore, general counsel of TMP Worldwide Media. He is an esteemed academician, scholar, legal practitioner, and above all else, my brother-in-law. Emerson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Right. I'm really glad that you were able to be on. We've been trying to get you on for weeks, or at least since yesterday when I realized I didn't have a guest for this week.
When you realized you didn't have another guest and you were desperate?
That's right. So I'm really glad that you're so busy you were able to fit us into your schedule between taking a nap and watching television. But I am genuinely excited to have you on the show. You're at least one of the two best lawyers on the podcast right this instant. but you have an interesting story. You do have an interesting story. And I think your story speaks to a lot of what other lawyers are dealing with now of, you know, what direction do they want their legal career to go in? And
whether they're getting satisfaction from their job. So let me just give the people a little bit of – or let's let you tell the background of how you decided to go to law school, become a lawyer, and how your career unfolded.
Well, I really didn't have any plans of being a lawyer when I was an undergrad. I actually had a lot of friends after graduating who were, in fact, in law school, who all told me, oh, you know, you'd be great at this. This is fantastic. But the thing that really sparked my interest was a friend of mine who told me he had a he was a summer associate and he was making more money than he could spend. And as you know, money makes the world go round for me anyway. And so I was like, what do you mean? And so that was the first thing that really sparked my interest. But then I decided
the money
to,
part. You know, so it wasn't about justice or helping the poor or the indigent. It was about
no, none of that.
It was
none
money.
It was money.
Okay.
And so I actually went to law school to be the black Jerry Maguire, but that didn't.
Well, by the way, we should stop and tell people on the podcast that you are in fact black. That you weren't going to have a skin change operation.
Yeah, I wasn't Jewish trying to masquerade as the, although there are black Jews. I mean, Sammy Davis and others, you know.
And for example, like your sister, who is married to me. Right, by the way, podcast
not trying to besmirch any black Jews out there.
But podcast disclaimer, just so the audience listening knows, I am married to Emerson's sister. She is a black person like he is, and she is married to me and Jewish. So there that community exists.
And to show you how persuasive Mr. Barnett is, she converted
to
Judaism, yes.
That's right.
And so I wanted to go to law school to be the black Jerry Maguire because I had played ball. And, I had a bunch of guys, a bunch of buddies who were professional athletes. And they all, to a man, said, don't do it. It's a shady business. But me being the bullheaded, stubborn bastard that I am, said, no, I'm going to try it anyway. Had some experiences that proved to be true in what they were saying, like, you know, don't do it. It is a very shady business, at least the small part of it that I was introduced to.
Okay.
So then
we should tell people, because it is very impressive, you played basketball at University of Michigan with a very famous group of guys. Right.
Yeah, I played with the Fab Five, but it was technically the year after Chris Webber's timeout. So I replaced Chris Webber.
There you go. I mean, no one knows any different. I'm not gonna tell.
But the caveat is that I was a walk on. I never played. I never got any money and all that good stuff.
But you played with guys. You played with guys who made it to the pros, and that's very impressive.
I definitely did. And so I thought I wanted to be an agent. I thought I could change the landscape in that arena. But you know that wasn't to be. So anyway, ended up at Proskauer Rose, which is a firm with a fantastic sports practice. But, you know, it wasn't as sexy as, you know, Jerry Maguire's life sitting, you know, when you're, unless you're like the guy brokering like a labor dispute and Patrick Ewing and the Players Association is sitting across the table. And I wasn't in labor. I was in corporate. It wasn't all that sexy.
Nope.
So,
no one was saying like, show me the money.
No, there was none of that. There was definitely none of that. Just a lot of long hours and but a good place to learn and how to become a lawyer. So,
I'm sorry, go ahead. Finish your thought there. I'm sorry.
No, that was it.
Wait, but you skipped over law school, which is actually an important part. A lot of our fans and listeners are law students. So we should talk a little bit about your law school and where you went and your career there.
Oh, okay. Well, I went to New York Law School, which was great for me. I really only applied to schools in New York City. I wanted to come to New York, one, because I knew I wanted to, you know, be in entertainment with either California or L.A. or New York. My sister, as you know, was living in New York at the time. So I said, okay, I'll try New York. I didn't have the best grades or the most stellar LSAT scores. So I applied to New York Law School and Brooklyn Law School, got into both, went to New York Law School, had a fantastic experience. Really can't speak more highly of NYLS. And I knocked the cover off the ball my first year. I really, unlike most of my years of college, I really I really sat down and applied myself. And so things went very well in law school. And, you know, law school was great. Like, people say, oh, I hate law school.
I say that all the time, by the way.
I wish I could go back to law school. I had internships. I had offices. I mean, it was great. I had a television in my office. I had a great time in law school.
Sounds like an NCAA violation in law school.
It does. See, you know, the things I wasn't able to get in Michigan, I was able to get in law school. So that's fate would have it.
Like, listen, being a 6'5" or 6'6" law student is much better than being a 6'5" walk-on at the University of Michigan. Now, all of a sudden, now you're the captain of the Lawyers League team or something.
Shout out to my Lawyers League team. We won the championship. We got to the championship 3 years in a row.
No wonder. It was you and four short Jewish guys from Brooklyn playing against five short Jewish guys from Brooklyn.
So law school was great. And then, you know, I got the City Bar Fellowship. And I went to work for K-Show my first year, got an offer from them. I'll never forget, I got an offer making the offer was for $83,700. I remember calling my mom thinking I hit the lotto. $83,000.
Right.
And then by the time I started, it was up to $125,000. So, you know, I thought they were printing money.
Right.
And so it was a glorious time.
That's awesome. Now if someone offered you $83,000, you'd be insulted. You'd throw it back in their face.
I'd get out my potato peeler and my bandana and just get to the back.
Right. So we skipped ahead. You were already at Proskauer. You were doing corporate law, and you did that for a number of years, correct?
Yeah, I was at Proskauer for I think I just started my eighth year when I left.
Okay, well, that's quite some time. So what caused you to decide that you wanted to you know, move away from that and go in-house as you have?
Well, one thing was, you know, definitely the quality of life. A few things. One, first and foremost, is the quality of life. I mean, I knew, I got married. I knew I wanted to have a family. And, you know, my mentor, my rabbi at the time, I saw how he was working, you know, well into his 50s with kids who were, you know, soon to be in college or in college. And, you know, and I told him the day I came in and told him I was leaving, like, you know what, I don't want to be you. And I didn't mean that in a rude way, but it was, you know, hey, I want to tuck my kids in at night. And that really means a lot to me and still does to this day. Like, you know, some of my friends who are partners now, you know, if I'm in their office and like, oh, you know, I'll be right with you. Or it's 9 o'clock and they're scrambling, trying to catch a train. And, you know, that's just so not my life now. The trade-off is the money.
You know? And we come back full circle to what started you down this path in the first place. You wanted to make money, and now you've given up the money.
Yeah, now you've given up the money. But, I mean, there's two ways to think about that. I mean, I walked away the year I would have been up. Who's to say they would have, you know, promoted me and I would have been able to make partner? And as fate would have it, they started this non-equity partner nonsense the year that I came up. You know, I think they did that, you know, it was anti-Semitic. They did that, to hold me back.
Because now you're Jewish. Okay, good.
I'm Jewish by marriage.
I knew we'd get you eventually. There you go.
I invoke my Sammy Davis rights whenever I can.
Okay. So you moved on and you moved in-house. Now, how is the in-house life? Has it met your expectations, or has it differed from the expectations you had of it?
No, I think what's really hard to know what to expect. I mean, you really have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I was working primarily for private equity companies, most of which didn't have general counsels. So I didn't have a whole lot of insight into what a general counsel did or does. I really didn't know what to expect. I mean, I knew that the way that I was trained to think both in undergrad and as a lawyer, that I could probably tackle any problem that was thrown my way. But it was like, you know, I don't really know what to do. You know, if you know, we'll take it as it comes. You know, we'll take it as it comes. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, it's like there's no every problem has a solution. Like, you know, there's no reason to panic and say, oh, I won't be able to do it. Unless it's something technical that requires some type of, you know, if you're an SEC, you know, 40 Act, you know, lawyer, securities lawyer, and you've been doing, you know, litigation your whole life, right, clearly you're not going to be well suited to fulfill that the requirements of that position.
Well, what do you do about that? So, because you were a corporate lawyer, what do you do when there's a dispute, a piece of litigation? Do you have in-house litigators? Do you farm that out? How do you make?
No, I farm pretty much everything out. My associate general counsel is an IP expert, and given you know what our sweet spot is, you know, that was a great hire, if I do, you know, say so myself. But anything other than that, you know, we farm it out, and it's easy. I mean, and it's efficient, and we do everything we can to wrap our arms around what the issue is, so you don't, you know, you're not relying, you're not handing, you know, outside counsel just, you know, an empty blank piece of paper. Like, you try to, you know, frame it as much as you can to keep your costs down, because at the end of the day, everything comes back to the bottom line when you're working for, you know, for a company.
Now, for the people who are listening who aren't yet lawyers, who are second and third year students, perhaps, who are thinking about in-house as a possible career path, how is that career itself, since you've been in it, what is it, 5 years now, 4 years?
It's been six.
6 years, okay. So in the 6 years you're there and now looking ahead, how is that specific career changing, or how has it changed in ways that are good or bad?
I don't know if it's changed a whole hell of a lot in the 6 years that I've been here. I will say that, you know, the whole landscape of the legal profession has changed. So I know that I get pursued and courted by law firms a whole hell of a lot more than I did when times were better. I think things have changed dramatically for law firms, as you know.
You mean to be a client, for you to be their client?
Right. Okay. I think that they're trying new and creative things to try to get, you know, additional clients, different billing, retainers, whatever it may be, expanding, you know, globally, whatever it is, bringing in like boutique groups of lawyers for niche practices, whatever it may be. I think that has definitely changed, and there's definitely been an uptick in that. But I mean, the legal profession, it is what it is. I mean, but for me, it basically comes down to relation. Well, naturally, you have to be talented and you have to know what the hell it is you're doing.
Yeah.
But after that, it's relationships. Like, I like to be able to get on the phone with someone and, you know, and be me and tell the story and get it done and work with somebody that I number one, respect their work and like, you know.
Right. Now, as a black man, you're still black now, right, at this point in the call?
And I think I'm going to continue to be. But, I mean, Michael Jackson was able to change that. Right. So
let's assume, though, you continue to be a black person. What are your views on how – I got a big thumb there on this guy. What are your views on how the legal community is changing, if at all, with respect to minority hiring and minority training of, you know, of minority lawyers, whether black or Latino or Asian? I mean, you know, it's historically been very white dominated, obviously.
But I mean, you know what? I recently had this conversation, and I've had it for like the last God knows how many years. Like, at the end of the day, I think, you know, talent and money, you know, rule the world, right? So I honestly believe that if you are a talented lawyer, right, regardless of your skin color, and again, I shouldn't say that, regardless of your skin color, but you have, if you make your bones and you're in the right spot, then you will make it. And if you have clients and you're bringing them to the table, and who knows what that relationship could be, that at the end of the day, that's all firms care about. So all this about, oh, well, firms, we have a diversity committee and we're doing this. And I think that's so contrived, because you can't, like, my mentor is Jewish, right, at Proskauer, and go figure. And, but, I mean, you would never, if you looked, if you lined us up, our statistics of who we are, our resumes next to each other, you would never think that he and I had any type of bond or would ever be able to establish any type of rapport. Right. I think it's something that has to happen organically. So I think firms, they try to do all this stuff and, oh, you know, oh, we've got the African-American committee for this and we've got the Asian committee and the lesbian and the gay committee and it's all this stuff. And it's just like, you know what? Just come in, work hard, try to find a mentor and bust your hump and prove you can do things. Now, granted, there's a whole lot that goes on that you might not get the same opportunities that others get. But at the end of the day, it's being smart and hard work. You know what I mean? It's I think...
Well, I wouldn't know much about that because I think that despite my hard work and I hope my intelligence, I did very poorly in my legal career, so which is why I'm a comedian. So I'm not sure. I might be the exception maybe that proves your rule. But let's assume and hope that you're correct, that law is race and ethnicity neutral. Let's talk about something much more important than you and your legal career. Let's talk about me for a second. We've known each other for some time. Your sister and I are married. We have a beautiful son. When are you guys going to come visit us?
Well, you guys, what country do you live in? You live in what?
We live in civilization. You're the ones who chose to live across the river in Brooklyn. Now,
no, see, you are the uncivilized Manhattaners. Everybody knows Brooklyn's the coolest place on the planet. And we've got all those bridges were built so you guys could get to Manhattan, not the other way around.
That's right. Come to Manhattan. That's exactly right. People from the exurbs and
stuff. I'm sorry. It's late. It's late on a Sunday. I meant for all you guys to get to Brooklyn, not for us to come to Manhattan.
Well, all right. I take issue with that. Everyone knows the center of the universe is Manhattan. When they say New York City, they mean Manhattan. They don't mean you know, like Brooklyn Heights, where, for example, I was born, or Canarsie, where my mom grew up, or whatever. You know,
Brooklyn's got better steak, a better basketball team.
We have to talk about basketball for 2 seconds. You're right, because look, you played ball.
Well, actually, both teams suck, so I shouldn't have really said that.
You know what's funny is for the listeners, I am a very big Knicks fan, but midway through the season, I said to somebody, the Knicks will never get past the Pacers because the Pacers are an amazing defensive ball club. I said this. I wish I had the tape of it because I said it. And what
everybody
happened,
comes out with these, like, oh, I was a prophet when I midseason. I said it to somebody.
True, it's true.
It was a homeless guy. It was Eddie Murphy pretending not to have any legs.
That's right. But
I said it to that guy.
But possibly. But true to form, the Knicks lost last night because the other team has better defense and bigger. And your Nets team in Brooklyn are really, I mean, they play like, I don't know what. They play like a bunch of guys in a lawyers league.
Yeah, they play really the guys in the Lawyers League are very enthusiastic, as I can remember them. I haven't played in the Lawyers League in forever. But, you know, the Knicks, they're hot. They're a hodgepodge of crazy guys with tattoos of kisses on their necks, guys going out partying, like guys coming in drunk. And I don't know, man. I don't know.
All right, well, we have to wrap up, but let's give you the last word. I want to give you a chance to plug something that you're working on or doing or want to do that you want to plug. And I also want to get a basketball prognostication from you for this year's finals and also next year's Knicks and Nets. So start any way you want. You want to plug something, let's do it that first. You want to end with the plug, up to you.
Well, let's start with the basketball prognostication. I was actually thinking that the Miami Heat, if they made it to the finals past the Pacers, which I think they will, would face Memphis, and Memphis would maul them. But then the guy from Michigan State, and go figure, because he's a Michigan State Spartan, Zach Randolph, just scored 2 points against the Spurs. So who knows what's going to happen. Miami could mess around and win the game, but Miami doesn't have any big men. But I really like LeBron James just because of his overall game. I hope that they go on to win like 3 or 4 consecutive championships, much to the chagrin of all Knicks fans everywhere. my beloved Pistons are pitiful. And I don't see anything good coming of anything that they're doing anytime soon. Shout out to my friends who work for the Pistons. And as my sister once told me, real people don't advertise. So I'm not talking about anything that I hope to do because inevitably it will come back to bite me in the hind parts. So I will end my basketball prognostication on Trey Burke, the player of the year for Michigan, being rookie of the year next year in the NBA, and the Miami Heat winning their third championship this year, winning their second. Next year, winning their third, barring injury.
Okay, that's all right.
I'm sorry that this podcast. You told me I couldn't curse, so for me not cursing, it's like you know, telling the chef he can't use his favorite spice. So I'm sorry the podcast wasn't
as funny
as it could have been.
It wasn't funny, but you know, if you need to be dirty to be funny. You need to be on Eddie Murphy
like
or Chris Rock podcast. Now you said you don't want to advertise, but do you want to plug anything? Do you want to? I mean, anything you're up to, like Lawyers League? You know, you're now the towel guy or something like that, or.
No, I'm playing in this league in Long Island, in Little Neck, Long Island. It's 35 and over league, and my team today sadly lost by 42 points today. So that gives you an understanding of where I am basketball wise right about now. I lost in a 35 and over league, although my team is awful. I have the worst team ever. I swear to God, there's some fifth graders.
They're way over 35.
Oh my God! They're 35 going on 72. they're really bad.
All right. Well, let me sign out here. So everybody, thank you so much for listening. Again, this has been Emerson Moore, my brother-in-law, and also more importantly, General Counsel of TMP Worldwide, and beloved husband and father of two beautiful boys. And shout out to them. And we're gonna sign off. Move to Good Cop, Bad Cop and finish off this podcast. All right, so we're going to go to Good Cop, Bad Cop.
Sorry about that. I just, I saw how aggressive you were being and I thought, wow, I got to go even bigger than that since we're doing Bad Cop, Bad Cop.
What? No, I said Good Cop, Bad Cop. I'm the bad cop, you're the good cop.
Okay, then there it is. That's it. I thought you said Bad Cop, Bad Cop.
All right, Kev, this week we've got Good Cop, Bad Cop. As always, neither one of us is either one of those things, but let's pretend. Have you checked our Twitter account to see what's going on there?
It didn't take a lot of checking because our listeners suck.
No, they they don't suck. They listen to us.
Well, they might listen, but I don't know. I don't know. We have nothing. We have no. Last week with Matt, I begged, I pleaded, I offered to bleed myself. For our listeners, and we got nothing. We got more followers though. We did pick up another 5 followers, so we're constantly picking up more followers on Twitter. The podcast is being listened to. Somebody right now is hearing my voice. Well, not right now, but right whenever now, they're hearing it, they're hearing
right now. When they just heard it, they would have heard it right now.
Exactly. When will now be then? Right now.
Right
now. But and so I'm saying again, if you're listening to me, if you hear me, just tweet at us. Just you have Twitter. You know where Twitter is. You know how to get there. You probably have an account. You probably tweet out mundane nonsense. So just tweet at us. Tweet at comediansatlaw.com, hashtag CalPod. Say something, anything. Say Kevin sucks. Say Kevin should be kicked out
Kevin
of the group.
Kevin sucks.
Say, all right, well, you already have a T-shirt.
That's true. I'm more than one.
Say Alex Barnett is the worst driver in the tri-state area.
That's not true.
It might be true. It's possibly true.
It's possibly true, but not possible.
Say anything. But if you tweet at us, this and I'm removing all limitations here. Just tweet at us, and I'll send you a T-shirt. There. It's that easy. You get a T-shirt for a tweet. Instead of taking a picture of your sandwich that you're eating at some obnoxious cafe in Manhattan and posting it on Twitter – tweet at us, and you get a free T-shirt. And actually, if you want to tweet at us with a picture of your sandwich, I'll still send you a T-shirt.
Better if the sandwich is in the tweet.
Yes, absolutely. Tweet me a sandwich, and you get a T-shirt.
I like that. CalPod sandwich T-shirt.
There you go.
CalPod plus sandwich equals T-shirt. That's an equation. We should tweet that out right now. Are you on the Twitter?
Yes.
Tweet that to our followers right now. CalPod, hashtag CalPod plus sandwich. Sandwich pick equals T-shirt. All right. Well, obviously, we so if we can't give away a T-shirt this week, we've made our pitch for next week. We've told people about our upcoming shows. We've given people our views of the news. And we came up with a great idea for a new television show, a new law television show.
This might have been our most productive podcast ever.
I know. It was like a it was like a working session, and I like that.
So people really, they got to hear how terrible comedy is, and they got to see how comedy happens, and they you might even get a free T-shirt out of this, folks. We're giving you so much content for nothing.
Yeah, I like it. All right, well, let's sign off then. So for Comedians at Law, this is Alex Barnett.
This is Kevin Israel.
And we'll catch you next week.